he should be aware of, but apparently he's not aware that demanding your entire workforce to come back into the office 5 days a week is just not good business practice on so many different levels. It's not good business to piss off your employees. It's not good business to have disgruntled people schlepping into the office. It makes zero sense. And the fact that the governments are towing this old-timey business line of everyone needs to come into the office is just hurtful.
When the CEO of AT&T, not that long ago, made all these comments, and Stacey, I imagine you were very familiar with this.
Oh, I wrote about that.
And that just completely blew up in his face. And all these HR experts, and there was research done, and there were surveys, like there were so many of them that said the same thing, that no, productivity was up with hybrid work, with people like not being in the office all the time. They were happier.
Not to mention the people who are just able to work at all. Disabled people, women with children, family caregivers, who actually are able to work now.
Right. And these comments from the AT&T CEO, who's equated this lack of loyalty to your employer as basically, if you're not totally loyal, get out.
Yeah. I interviewed one professor in particular, Julian Barling. His theory is that Stanky likely doesn't believe this either, that he may be getting pressure from his board of investors who want to see cuts happening. And so he's throwing out this memo to go viral, to send a message to investors that he's going to be taking a hard line. But his memo was very vague. It said these things about refocusing on market-led performance metrics, but there wasn't really anything super concrete in it.
After the break, we're going to talk about what some young employees have recorded when they've been fired. I'm going to quote from a piece that the renowned economist Paul Krugman, he wrote last year for The Guardian. And Krugman, for anyone who doesn't know, is the Nobel Prize winning economist, former MIT and Princeton prof. And for about a quarter of a century, he was this award-winning New York Times columnist. And the headline of the piece that he penned for The Guardian last year was How the Unforced Error of Austerity Wrecked Britain. Different dynamics, I'm going to make this clear, like the austerity that he was referring to in the UK was when there was really high unemployment and the economy overall was in a much worse condition than it is today. But here's what he was getting at about like these CEOs and unfortunately, like too many politicians. He said, quote, I used to talk about the push for austerity, like with cuts and measures to reduce the size of government, to make public sector cuts, to like fund different programs, to reduce deficits, etc. He said that a lot of this was, quote, being led by very serious people. This was not really a joke. If you spend any time consorting with members of the global policy elite, you realize that many of them are driven primarily by the desire to appear, quote, serious. In economic terms, this usually means pushing policies that will cause significant hardship to other people, of course. Quote, the obsession with perceived seriousness reflects peer pressure, but in some ways also reflects personal careerism. And I think that between Ford and Carney, we've got these two similarly aged men. They have a very similar demographic profile. And clearly, they want to be seen as serious people. But the question I guess I have is, what will happen when Ford's move backfires, when Carney's move backfires, when Carney's move is shown to be little more than a series of cuts that undermines the public service? It actually reduces the ability of the government to generate investment, to grow the economy. It reduces the government's ability to bring in revenue. For example, like cuts to the CRA, why aren't you going after the hundreds of billions of dollars that we know through the Panama Papers aren't being collected? Guess what? You're not going to help bring in that revenue if you cut that department even further. And I just wonder, from your point of view, Stacey, is this very much like a bureaucratic, detached, disconnected kind of elite response instead of What we would rather see, if you're a real businessman, Mark Carney, which you're not, you're an elite individual who's worked in the boardrooms of the highest levels of financial management, and you've been the governor of two national central banks, and Doug Ford doesn't have the greatest resume in terms of being like an entrepreneur, like a guy who built a business. Yes, there's the family business that his dad built, but it just seems to me that the people who are going to be most negatively impacted by all of this are the people who can afford these impacts least. Young Canadians, women in the workplace, newcomers. Stacey, like, it just seems so short-sighted.
Yeah, it's short-sighted. This makes me think about when pandemic lockdowns happened and everybody went online and people had their eyes opened as to what their lives would be like when it wasn't centered around their work. And they learned that life was good when they weren't being stressed out every single day because of a job they were doing. And when we came back from the pandemic, there was this moment that I really noticed, especially when I first started writing about these topics, that workers and employees had a moment of power, I think. We had bargaining power where we realized our value and what our priorities were. And we started saying no and saying no publicly. And social media helped with this. And there was the trends on TikTok where people were recording being laid off. And there was all this sort of bad press for big companies that was happening.
So thank you for taking the time to meet with us today. Unfortunately, your employment will be terminated effective immediately.
Can I ask why I'm being let go today?
Yes, we were just thinking it wasn't a great fit.
I feel like I've done every step of the way of trying to do this job to the best of my abilities. And quite frankly, you've made it very difficult.
Thank you for the feedback.
And I feel like we sort of missed an opportunity because I feel like what we're witnessing right now is the large players, the financial institutions, the traditional business standards that have kept these certain demographics very wealthy and with a lot of power. I feel like we're seeing a grasping back of that. Okay, you workers have had your moment of enjoying work-life balance and working remotely, but now it's time for you to get back in the office and do what we tell you to do, because that's how we're going to continue doing business the way we've always done it. And too bad.
And the gains that women have made, perhaps, like we remember about a decade ago with Justin Trudeau coming in and like this priority, and we're going to have like women in cabinet positions and we're going to address women's issues really seriously.
It's an incredible pleasure for me to be here today to present a cabinet that looks like Canada.
I understand one of the priorities for you was to have a cabinet that was gender balanced. Why was that so important to you?
Because it's 2015.
Now we find out that these public service cuts might directly impact the ministry that specifically focused on women's issues. And I'm going to read to you some stats. And of all the departments that apparently, like from some early reporting, that are going to be most impacted by the cuts that Mark Carney has alluded to, that he's basically signaled will likely be happening. Here's some data. The CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, of the just over 59,000 employees, almost 60% are not men. And then we go to Employment and Social Development Canada. Of its almost 40,000 employees, 67%, two-thirds, are not men. Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship, more than 13,000 employees, same thing, almost two-thirds, they're not men. And yes, when we talk about the RCMP and National Defense, there are more men in those agencies. Stacey, my feeling is that corporate culture, like 9-to-5 cubicle culture,
it sucks. The research has been done. The surveys have been done. Scholarly research has been done. it doesn't make sense for everybody to be in the office 5 days a week. It just doesn't. Not only logistically for people spending hours driving into offices where they're uncomfortable, neurodivergent employees hate being in the office 5 days a week. I myself, a neurodivergent person, I doubt I would still be in this job, frankly, 2 years on if I wasn't able to work from home. You know, like, this is a big deal.
A lot of office spaces aren't even equipped. Like, those who are neurodivergent, those with, like, other types of accommodations that need to be in these office spaces but don't get them there.
And all that stuff requires time, thought, effort, and spending money. It doesn't cost that much to accommodate a disabled person, a neurodivergent person. But it does take the actual concern and care and intent to do it, which doesn't usually happen until someone speaks up and says, hey, I need an accommodation. And that is a whole other issue where asking for accommodations is it's a huge barrier.
And what about middle-aged women? If you're mid-career and all of a sudden you face this type of disruption, again, like, I just wonder if a guy like Mark Carney or Doug Ford would even understand this.
Yeah, they don't. And that's the thing. Like, there's no reason for them to have any concept as to why what they are proposing and doing is so very financially damaging to so many people.
And economically damaging to the whole country. If he thinks that this is a good economic model to alienate like a huge segment of your labor market that are trained and they're educated and you've put money into that education, and now this is the way you're going to basically undermine that, like, economically, you might as well just take a blowtorch to the economy.
What I feel like the result is going to be as all of these laid off people are going to be scrambling to find work. It's almost chaotic. And I don't think I need to reach for research to point out the obvious disparity in the rates of women being hired compared to men, of racialized women who get the worst of basically everything every single time. And now with algorithms as well, with AI hiring algorithms, bias is built right into those algorithms, unless it's intentionally built out of the algorithm. Hiring algorithms that are selecting resumes, selecting applications, it mirrors the person who's hiring's bias. And it's also been shown that even if the algorithm succeeds in presenting a 50-50 split of men and women applicants to a hiring manager, it still doesn't really make a significant difference because that hiring manager will still hire according to their bias.
Stacey, what is the business sector and specifically leaders, like entrepreneurs in the tech sector, in traditional sectors, young leaders, those in C-suites, what do they need to do if we're not going to get leadership that we need from our politicians? And we can talk a little bit about media coverage that, as you said, our polite Canadian media that doesn't really want to delve into all the contextual and the broad consequences of this, especially like with a publication like yours that to a great extent appeals to the management class who reads your publication. What do they need to do if there's going to be a correction or if there's going to be a progressive sort of future? What do we need to see from the business sector?
It needs to be a very intentional effort to structure out that bias, because that bias is always going to happen. It is so unconscious, the misogyny, sexism, racism, what have you. That unconscious bias is so unconscious that it's very difficult to train that out. So what you need to do is really intentional practices. For example, this has been posed to me, a few different researchers, a format for promotions inside organizations. Instead of offering a position and inviting people to apply, you flip that on its head and give people the option to opt out. So everybody's going to be considered to be applying for this promotion, this internal promotion, unless they opt out, because research has shown that women are far less likely to apply for promotions than men. So things like that, accepting that the bias is there, identifying the internal bias that exists and then creating policies and standards and practices to counter that bias.
Stacey, to what you said earlier in the show about how this seems like a Sisyphean task with gains are made for a few years, but then the group that's benefited for decades from inequities and all these terrible policies and like the old boys kind of culture and network, as you said, they seem to be pushing back now.
Yeah. Well, they're pulling back.
And I don't think this is going to change. And it's not just south of the border. Stacey, on this show, we like to duly note stories that we feel are flying under the radar. Do you have a story that you'd like to duly note?
I do. I studied German history in school, so this is something that stood out to me. The news coverage of RFK Jr. in the States, his obsession with autism and direct statements targeting autistic children and their lack of value to society and their inability to contribute and all of these very harmful and very untrue statements. And I cannot help but see and think of how this sort of parallels what happened in Nazi Germany when autistic children and disabled adults were sent to special clinics where they were euthanized. And so every time I'm reading about this with the situation in the States and I'm seeing these messages coming from a very, very high-ranking politician, it makes me very afraid and nervous. And so what I wonder is, at what point do journalists start to talk about this and point out these parallels, which actually do exist?
Yeah, and we know that even across Canada, there are pockets and there's definitely this narrative that's out there in this country about vaccines and the links to autism. So, yeah, duly noted. I would like to duly note some reporting by The Pointer, the platform that I own, and a shout out to our incredibly enterprising reporter, Ed Smith, who launched a Freedom of Information investigation a few months ago. And something that was being missed in the last few years with hyperinflation and the economy struggling and just the hardship that Canadians were facing. And then we see cutbacks at the federal government level, and we've seen cuts with provincial governments across the country. We see more and more of the downloading, that austerity, those cuts, this belt tightening, this reaction to these tough economic times that we're still in, has fallen to municipal governments. Municipal governments are asking to do more in terms of funding, like higher percentages of public housing. In Ontario, quote, local share commitments for healthcare, like major hospital projects, like we saw Mississauga asked to pay $450 million for a new hospital. We're seeing that all across the province now. Municipalities are funding things like food banks as a consequence of the economic reality. And with all of that pressure, property taxes have skyrocketed in a lot of municipalities. And Ed Smith did this amazing reporting where he FOI'd property tax arrears data and information in a couple of municipalities. And what he found in these two Niagara municipalities, St. Catharines and Niagara Falls, that the rates of people going into arrears on their property taxes, it is now at a crisis level, to the point that his reporting has prompted the councils to start addressing it.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Mayor. It's not much of a request. It's just to add information into our budget statistics, including the number of property in arrears of property taxes, so we have a better handle on the information.
Okay, we'll do that through a direction. Thank you.
We have people who are at risk of losing their homes because they can't pay their property taxes because municipalities are having to cover more and more of the costs of this drawn out economic situation that we've been in. And I just want to duly note that reporting and that reality.
Duly noted.
That's our show for today. Stacey, thank you again for joining us on the show. Where can people find you?
Google Canadian HR Reporter. I am there reporting every day on legal developments in the employment world in Canada, employment trends, worker trends, human rights topics. I cover all of that. So come on over and read that stuff.
Listeners or anyone else can find me at san.grewal@thepointer.com. That's san.grewal@thepointer.com. This episode is produced by Tristan Capocchione. The associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier, who also did the fact-checking, mixing and mastering by Tom Sayers. Our director of audio is Max Collins. The editor and publisher of Canadaland is Jesse Brown. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Something feels so right under this tent tonight. I've heard this voice. I've made this choice already.
Or is that now part of your act? Your drinking's made you lose your touch with sleight of hand. How do you expect me to react?
How am I to focus when you're at my throat? Do you believe I really care what you think? Hello, Mr. Clown Man, I wondered if you had some room for one wrong in the game. I want to be part of the grand circus art. I'd sell peanuts and work for the same.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Erin Caffell began writing her first novel after seeing the destruction caused by Superstorm Sandy.
It gave me really specific nightmare fuel for what it looks like when the worst-case scenario happens.
She imagined how people might respond after an even more extreme climate disaster.
How people would create spaces of kindness and support, and also how people would create the opposite of that out of fear.
Her novel, All the Water in the World, is set in a future New York City that's been flooded by rising seas. The main characters live on the roof of the American Museum of Natural History and try to protect the objects inside.
This was in large part inspired by so many stories across the globe and across time of curators staying behind during war, during weather crises, to protect collections.
But when a massive storm destroys the city's remaining seawalls, the characters flee in a canoe. They paddle up the Hudson River seeking safety. In some places, they encounter desperate, ruthless people. But they also find helpers and caring communities. So the novel invites readers to think about how to rebuild after climate disasters.
About what it looks like to come out on the other side and begin to make a future.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Radio Rewind.